IROC Space Radio.
Roger, restart. Now looking at
three, two, one, mark.
It's now time for the Space Revolution with Rick Tomlinson.
Hey there, spacers. Welcome back to another episode of Space Revolution. My name is Rick Tomlinson. You are listening to IROC Space Radio. And as you know, we're part of the iHeartRadio Network. We have a fun guest today, tonight, whenever you're listening to this on this little sphere we call home. And it's going to be interesting. And, you know, I think you're going to get some stuff out of it, especially the younger crowd. I'll put it that way, right? We're somebody who's coming up here. And we'll figure it out. Generation Z, Alpha, I don't know anymore. I can't tell anymore. But all right, so our guest tonight, today, is Ari Eisenstadt. Now, Ari comes out of Wisconsin and got his bachelor's at the University of Wisconsin. And now, having made what I think is probably a wise choice climate-wise, is at the University of Hawaii, where he's a PhD candidate. He's engaged in future studies. He's got his fingers in a lot of things, human rights, engineering, astrobiology. One of these people who's far too smart. And but he's here with me, which, you know, well, actually proves he's not very smart. But, you know, we're going to have some fun, talk about a lot of different topics, I feel. Ari has been at a couple of my Our New Worlds, Earthlight events, very successful topics that he's dealt with there. And I'm not going to spend too much more time on this. Ari, welcome.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's really an honor to be here.
Hey, it's my honor, sir. So let's get started with a couple of things. One is you've had some interactions and depending, I'll just dive right in, kind of not what I spoke to you about at the beginning before we went on the air, but you've had some interactions with the eclipse stuff, right? And, you know, eclipse is a space thing. There's no doubt about it, right? It's a thing that happens in space. But for you, because I know you are an advocate of the cause, and we have some slightly different things. We'll get different angles on it. We'll get into later. But what's the significance, do you think, for a modern day audience in terms of the eclipse and how that relates to opening the frontier, to going into space?
Yeah, absolutely. And excited to dive in on eclipses. And to clarify, yeah, I grew up in Florida, actually, and went to space camp as a kid. So close in, you know, seeing those shuttle launches and wanting to be an astronaut. I won that MVP camper award, the right stuff. We won the best mission, our team. And I learned there, though, that the only way to pilot a spacecraft at the time was to go through the military. And so in my middle school wisdom, you know, around the year 2000, mm-hmm. I said, you know, I'll wait for the private sector to get there and go into business. And so I studied finance at the University of Wisconsin and then went out to Silicon Valley and started a social venture capital fund. And it was really in the last 5 years that I've seen that the space economy really is there. So I moved out to the University of Hawaii to work on a PhD in future studies. And Hawaii is one of the only future studies departments in the world. And so here I'm looking at the future of humanity in space. And so it's been really exciting to look at that from a political science side of hosting programs with the United Nations Association and the Outer Space Innovation and Advocacy Series. I've been involved with many different UN agencies around advocacy focused on sustainable development and human rights. But there hasn't been much on space. And when we do these programs, they're usually just for the space community and people that are in the space economy or the public sector. And so to your question around eclipses, I think that that's a really unique opportunity for everyone to get that overview effect and really be hit with, oh, we're on a planet, we're in space, and really to experience the uniqueness of, especially in the path of totality. I think that the difference between 99 and 100% is night and day. To be able to see the stars come out during the day, and that really was the turning point in our modern understanding of physics. In 1911, that was the experiment that we were able to see the difference between the stars at night and during the day. And the gravitational lensing really completely changed the paradigm from Newtonian to Einstein and relativity. And I think that now, especially with the eclipse of 2017, and now this eclipse in 2024, we're seeing these major paradigm shifts around our understanding of space, especially as we go back to the moon and have permanent space settlements. So I think that these types of experiences of millions of people seeing these celestial astronomical events are a really powerful way of opening that door of seeing why space is so important and relevant to our lives.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, aside from the question of who gets sacrificed, we can leave that out. But I do think that there are very few shared moments of awe, right? That we all, you know, can experience, and eclipses are certainly that kind of thing. Your background, and I meant to ask you the background question first, but thank you for taking us back there. That was very nice of you. You've really come at this from many different angles, and we're going to get back into your personal story in a little bit here. But at the University of Hawaii, your concept, your core thing that you're building, I guess, your academic progress around is futurism, right? And so you're applying all these other things, all these other topics, there are subtopics within that, to the idea of futurism. Now, I'm going to be frank with you. When I've dealt with quote-unquote futurists in the decades leading up until now, it was always incredibly frustrating to me, because I would go to a futurist event and space would be almost nothing. They wouldn't even, it was like not even on the agenda, right? It's not even something they would talk about in polite company almost. It was like, the futurism, you know, and so here you have a group of people who are prognosticating, planning, warning, developing for, moving us into in their minds the future, and yet for those of us like you and myself who get it when it comes to the fact that space is our future, they're not even talking about it. How, as a space guy yourself, coming into an academic area of futurism and future studies, How has that struck you? How has that interaction been with you? Are you one of a kind in your school, or are there more people who get it, you know, and understand that space is the future?
I share that frustration, and imagine that over those past years that it's been much more challenging. I come at the futures framework from a sustainable development space and looking at the United Nations development goals of these 15-year agendas. So I served as the International Chamber of Commerce, one of the representatives for the SDG negotiations in 2015, of looking for what is our collective agreement on our plans for 2030. And space was left out of that. We have pretty much... Yeah. Every other problem on Earth, ending poverty, healthcare for everyone, gender equality, education, climate action, peace, justice, and really the first time in the world that all the governments have agreed to something, and pretty monumental. And it's really been in the space community coming at it from the back of that, of saying how space can really help achieve these goals. And so I think that people are really focused on the issues of sustainable development, but may not be thinking about how we're really living in this space age, that all of our technology is space technology. Our food, water, energy, waste, manufacturing, communications, computation, it's all space technology. And I think that especially now, as we come up in this Artemis generation of going back to the moon to stay, as your brilliant phrase is mentioned, I think that really, we're going to start to see that again, the way that we did during that first space race. And there are fascinating geo and exopolitical issues around that, of how we relate to other countries, how we'll relate to back to the Earth. But I think that still we're living in a time where people are still focused on where their next meal will come from, immediate local challenges, and don't necessarily have that framework of why space is so important to addressing those day-to-day issues.
Why do you think that so-called futurists, who are smart people, right, don't include space in that equation, or haven't until recently?
I think going back to that idea that space in many areas has been just for the government, just for the military, and then even more recently, just for huge companies, that I think it's been inaccessible to people to really have an idea of how they can influence and how it could impact them. And so I think, again, with this new space movement, again, your term, that we're seeing it become democratized the way other technologies have. And I'm hopeful, especially as we see this new class of astronauts, from private astronauts to these new NASA astronauts, that we'll also have more representation and engagement in what space really means to everyone.
Yeah. I think it's also, I think it is, even with these brilliant people, I think that they've either categorized it as, hey, it's this big government thing over here, whatever, or we're using it as a telephone pole, we're stringing some communication wires up there and back, but it doesn't mean anything. And then anything fancier than that, this idea of people living out there is science fiction. It's a fantasy, of, maybe escapist is maybe what they're thinking of. What do you think about that? Like that they've written it off. Like, that's just these people watching too much sci-fi.
Yeah, I think I think the big challenge is the narrative around the billionaire class escapism, that they want to avoid the problems on Earth and go to Mars, go to the moon, go to their space yachts and avoid those problems on Earth. So I think that narrative has been a turnoff for the public. And I think, again, it's the opposite. All these technologies that we need to solve our climate issues, our technological, our environmental, our economic issues, they all really come from space technology. So I think it's that escapist mentality that's really harmful. And I think really not the case. I think that creating permanent settlements in space, having this renewed focus on a human space program and private space programs really, really directly benefit Earth. We're not sending the money to space. The money is being spent on Earth, and that technology, those investments, that education really ripples throughout all areas of society.
Definitely, definitely. Well, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back, and we're going to dive into a little bit of that. Billionaires abandoning the planet thing, and then bring it back into the environment and people today and their lives. So, all right, folks, you are listening to IROC Space Radio. My name is Rick Tumlinson. You can follow me at Rocket Rick on the Twitter X or X Twitter or whatever the heck you want to call it. You know what I'm talking about. And we've got Ari Eisenstadt, and we will be back in a moment. All right, Spacers, we're here with Ari Eisenstadt, and we are talking about kind of a wide-ranging conversation today, but from someone, who has sort of a younger take on it, who is kind of mixing it up in the internationalist arena. Ari, one of the things I admire about you is that you are diving into some areas that have either ignored what we're about, futurism, like we were talking about a few minutes ago, but also things like areas like the United Nations community. I've had some interactions there, but again, it's another group that it's in their face. It's right there in their face, but they don't get it, right? I when I talk, quite often I'll speak to, countries like Morocco or places like that, and I'll be over there talking, and it's very clear that they've almost been ghettoized when it comes to space, in the sense that, hey, you know, space for your country is like studying your crops. And, you know, and you can do some telecommunications from up there. But, you know, unless you're one of the big guys and one of the big kids, you don't get to play in this whole future in space. You know what I mean? And it's like, no, you can get involved. It's open for all of us. What do you think creates that perception?
Yes. I want to celebrate the work that the UN does around space, and mm-hmm. being, you know, incredibly underfunded and under-resourced in that area. And certainly at the end of the day, many of the critiques of the UN system come down to those member states. They only really have the power that is given to them by individual countries. Sure. But the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs, you know, has maybe 20 staff members and one of the largest mandates. And they've overseen some really powerful treaties that go to this day that need new updates now that we have this new space movement. But I think have really changed the dynamics of what peace work on Earth looks like. But we have the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, and that's something that I interviewed a past director of UNUSA, Simonetta DePipo. And yeah. She said one of her biggest achievements was increasing the number of signatories. And now there are over 100 countries involved. But we still are missing almost half of the world's countries. Almost a billion people don't even have a seat at the table of the decision making of what happens in international space policy. So I think, you know, I view myself as around this field of astro diplomacy. And I think that the UN really does great work on that, about democratizing access to space technology and helping these countries that don't have space programs get involved and up to speed on that. But yes, again, it's been, you know, we go through these different space ages of that first space age of, you know, just the superpowers, Cold War. Then after the Cold War, it's this, you know, era of ISS. And now I think around 2015, the era of reusable rockets, the 2015 Space Act Agreement of being able to use space resources. You know, now we're seeing this new era of equitable access to space, and I hope that that we see more international collaboration and support of developing countries and communities.
As you know, I worked a little bit with our community, our company, Deep Space Industries, on the 2015. Thing. And I know Simonetta, and nice lady. And it is an awareness thing. It is really a matter of understanding. I'll put it this way. I gave a talk a few months back in Delphi in Greece, and they had that attitude. You know, they stuck me over in a little room at this big economic forum, and which ironically had the title of like revolution, right? And you know, here we are. You and I know the big revolution, and I'm stuck in this little room. And I was getting this sort of attitude from some of my Greek friends that, hey, you know, we're not a space country. We're not, you know. And so I showed a bunch of images, and in each image, I said, okay, well, the U.S. is roughly 100 kilometers from space. And I said, China, 100 kilometers. Russia, China, 100 kilometers. Greece, oh, by the way, only 100 kilometers from space. Right. And then there was this argument of like, well, we don't have any money. And so I showed a fleet of yachts in, you know, in the harbor in Greece. So you do have the money, right, to do these things. And it is a psychological thing I think we're dealing with here, in that it's almost like giving, you know, we have a project called Permission to Dream that we talk about with education and telescopes and things like that. But at a cultural level, I think one of the missions you're engaged on, if I'm hearing you correctly, is this cultural idea of giving countries and people around the world permission to dream.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really something that these transformational events like eclipses can allow for. And I'm currently the space program director for the Texas Eclipse Festival, where we're excited to host these dream scopes where we'll have 10 astronauts now from every flight provider, leaders from NASA and private space, but also across music and art, around yoga, mindfulness, AI, Web3. I think it's again about not putting space in the corner, but really having it woven through our daily lives and our culture. And I think that's really so important again. And I'm hopeful, as you know, as we see more access to space, especially on the human side, as we see more of these amazing James Webb Space Telescope images, that we see that. And I think that information communication technology, these revolutions that are happening in our early educational systems, are also really influencing this next generation of leaders, to that even if they're not going into aerospace engineering, if they're in finance or media or the arts, that they keep space in their hearts and in their economic models.
So speaking of that, this generation that's rising, I from the outside, what I'm seeing is that, yes, there is a fascination with space. And, you know, it's hard to ignore the fact that almost every major hit movie, et cetera, you know, is space related, right? The biggest of the big. But also, though, at the same time, there is this ambiguity about it, and this narrative that we're seeing, where it is the rich boys and their toys, you know, that are going. And, you know, I can't go, and it's not a part of my world. In fact, they're trying to escape. You know, to me, it's fascinating that, for example, Jeff and Elon, you take two people that are really not, you know, the dark evil twins of industrial crushing the planet. You know, it's not like they're the Koch brothers or something. These are people who are fairly green, you know. What, I mean, Elon's building electric cars and stuff, but they've demonized them to this point where there's this kind of narrative that's going on in a younger community that they plundered and pillaged and they're leaving. What do you do when you run into that in your courses, in your classrooms? How do you deal with that?
I think that point, I've researched that data point for my dissertation, and of the top 10 grossing movies of all time, six directly involve multiplanetary civilizations. Of the 100, the vast majority involve space travel. I think even, at the bottom of the top 10 list is The Fast and the Furious. And they even, you know, strapped a hot rod to a rocket to go to space. So, space is ubiquitous to our culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are very real critiques around wealth inequality, our system around taxes, our system around social services. I mean, I look at it again from a human rights-based perspective. I teach, you know, many people in the U.S. know about the Bill of Rights, but few people know that we have an international Bill of Rights. And they comprise of these three main documents: the International Declaration of Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a non-binding treaty, but we have the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and then the Covenant on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights. And so the civil and political rights are those classic, you know, freedom of expression, of a fair trial, of due process, freedom of speech, to vote. And that really is represented by the U.S. and the Western countries. And then meanwhile, social, economic, and cultural rights are through what has traditionally been those socialist countries, the right to work, housing, healthcare, education. And the United States is one of the only countries that has not signed that treaty. And so I think we see a disconnect, and the challenges of having this extreme wealth, but not the universal human rights. And I think that that a lot would change around that perspective on resources and wealth creation if we had things like healthcare, education, housing for everyone. I think that these issues don't necessarily come from the personalities themselves. Rather they come from those systems of have-nots. That if I think we could do much better job fulfilling. And unfortunately, what NASA has taken a brunt of their critiques on, that we should be spending this money on people, you know, without those resources, when I think that that also is a major fallacy of, if you just look at the raw numbers of, you know, the few billions of dollars that NASA gets versus all the other things in the budget that could be spent on those social services. I think that's the real challenge. And I think that the private space exploration is very public and easy to make jokes on. And I think it's harmful for that cause of human progress.
Yeah, it's like, you know, let's cancel a half dozen F-35s, you know, and put that money into taking care of people. Yeah, I think you're heading towards something there, in that what we're talking about really is that these kinds of attacks, and look, we have to be absolutely clear. Some of these folks, friends of mine that we know, billionaire types, whatever, by the way, I'm not a billionaire, I just want to be clear, but, you know, they have the social skills of a coffee table. You know, they're just not unfiltered, they're whatever, and we have to give that, we understand that. But I think what you're saying is these attacks are more on the symbolism of the fact that they're building a rocket ship and I don't have clean water, right? It's that symbolism they're going after. It's not that there's anything wrong inherently with space itself that they have a problem with. It's that these people are so, in their mind, fabulously rich, and look what they're doing with the money instead of helping me.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are plenty of people that spend much more money on private jets or yachts or other you know, luxury expenses, but that just aren't as visible as creating a space company. And I think that's the challenge there. I think we need to talk more about our systems and our social supports, and how do we make sure that that we're making sure that everyone has those universal rights met, and then also that we're not creating a system where we're monopolizing space resources. I think that's also the concern, that we're going to have these first mover advantages to take up the valuable resources in space. And space is huge, and has, you know, it could completely change the global economy. You know, you think about this one Psyche asteroid that I think the statistics are quadrillions of dollars worth of precious metals. So it really changes the balance of how we should view scarcity in our economic models. But yeah, the concern is that if you have one person owning all those resources, that just really sets us up for social failure into the future.
Yeah, we're going to come back in and talk about that bigger moving out into the universe thing. I actually did an article called The Elysium Effect many years ago, where I was kind of warning the wealthy investors in space that once you guys start flying, they're going to come after you. You know, because it's a great big billboard that says "I have money," but we also need to understand that those funds they're putting into that are actually, in the end, for the benefit of humanity. Those are tax dollars we don't have to spend on it. And again, kind of knowing where I think these people come from, I think their goals are benevolent in the long run. I mean, you know, Jeff Bezos is a, you know, what I call a Jerry's kid, one of Dr. O'Neill's protege types, which was all about helping the planet, you know, in the long run. There's a lot of PR work that needs to be done there, a lot of communications work that needs to be done there for sure. But in the end, I think that it's really going to be show me, like, what do they do when they get out there? And that's kind of what we're going to talk about here in a moment, is as we're getting out of the atmosphere and out into the solar system, how do we handle that in a way that is equitable and allows people to participate? I have a feeling you and I may have a couple of slight differences there, or maybe not. We'll see. We'll be right back right after this. My name is Rick Tumlinson, at Rocket Rick on the X with Ari Eisenstadt. See you in a minute. Spacers, welcome back. It's the Space Revolution. My name is Rick Tumlinson. You are listening to iRock Space Radio, part of the iHeartRadio Network. Ari Eisenstadt is our guest. He is a polymath. He is an expert in engineering, astrobiology. human rights, futurism. Gosh, I don't know. Probably gardening. I don't know. We'll figure all that out. But we're having a great conversation. And again, I want to be really clear for everybody who maybe if this is the first time you're listening, a lot of what I do on this show is I'm discovering my guests at the same time you are. And we're having these conversations in real time. We don't have a list of a bunch of questions or this or that or the other. We have a couple of ideas when we start the show, and then we go where the conversation takes us. And I'm really enjoying this conversation with you, Ari. There are, in the space field, as in culture itself right now, there are a group of people who you might call the libertarians, which is like, let me go. I'm going to go to whatever the hell I want. Screw you guys. I'm going, you know? And there are the people who like, you can't do anything. We have to share it all with everybody. It's all, you know, we all have to share it with everybody. I think you and I may lean a little bit each way, but this idea of that there's going to be this sort of winner take all in space. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think that is a valid concern. Been doing some work with looking at space traffic management, space situational awareness, domain awareness, looking at low Earth orbit, and I think that there are major concerns around taking up orbital planes, about making low Earth orbit unusable for everyone. When we look at cislunar space, there are very important, valuable locations and resources on the moon. I love the terms of peaks of eternal light on the poles that always have access to the sun that are ideal for solar panels, or peaks of eternal darkness and in the craters where water is, which is the most valuable resource anywhere on the universe, anywhere in the universe. So I think that we should be intentional about these things. I think once we can get out to the asteroid belt and there'll be more resources than we can get our hands around. But in these next 10 years, it's going to be really critical that we have the awareness of sustainable development frameworks for that. And I think that we should be exploring and settling and utilizing space. And I think that we need to do that in a way that makes sure that it benefits Earth and that it allows the advancement of development into the future.
So there are, it's funny when you talk to the, shall we say, more diplomatic people from, let's say, China, and I was at a UN thing several years ago talking to one of them, and it's like, well, we support all the documents of the, keeping the commons and keeping everything open to everybody. And in my head, you always have this secret conversation. My conversation in my head was, oh, you mean like islands in the South China Sea, like those kind of islands, that belong to everybody? So there was a lot of diplomatic doublespeak that goes on out there, number one. Number two, most of the damage that I am seeing so far in low Earth orbit, most of the irresponsibility that I've seen exhibited is governments, not the private sector. It's governments who blow up satellites to prove they have ASAT capabilities. The private sector overall, I mean, you can have some arguments with, whether or not SpaceX's satellites are interfering with astronomical observation. That's a serious conversation we need to have. But as far as just this sort of grab it, take it, look, I'll put it this way, Ari. I would almost want to take all the governments, like on the moon, let's say. You were talking about the moon. I would love to take all the governments and have like this big treaty, and all the governments have to be on one base, like China, America, Russia, India, all on one base, and then let the regular folks do everything else, right? That way they all have to get along. How do you see this playing out in real time in your mind, as we move out? Go ahead.
I get the spirit of what you're saying. I think it's a fallacy, though. I think that we we distance ourselves from our governments and even from other countries. You know, we are obsessed with our own countries, where we exist in a political regime of the five UN Security Council members. And I think that we need more individuals and civil society to have direct stakes and say over what happens in international policy. And with the Outer Space Treaty, all private sector engagement of space, still similar to maritime law, is under the flag of their launching country. So, right. So I think that we've seen relatively responsible action by U.S. companies because they are governed by good regulation in the U.S. And I think that's not the case for other countries. I think that we've seen really historic and a special piece that has come out of the ISS and with the cooperation of Russia. And Apollo Soyuz is a great example. And at the height of the Cold War, we have these nuclear weapons pointing at each other, but we're able to coordinate on space policy and the rescue agreement. I think that that's really at risk right now with what's happening with the moon. We have now the Artemis Accords and on the other side, the International Lunar Research Station, which is being led by Russia and China. So I think that we're going to see, we are seeing a new split of two different blocks of countries and how they want to govern space. And they will determine how civil society and the private sector is able to operate. But I think, I think we need universal rights, universal regulations that really, again, honor those rights and make sure that we have freedoms and responsibilities in the right way.
So which part of that was the fallacy?
The disconnect between, I think, the government and the private sector and all of us. I think we need more of a stake in our governments. And I think that
I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, I think that NASA has been a great example of a civilian agency. And I think we need even more engagement with NASA. We need the peoples of those other countries to have a more engagement rather than through their militaries. We need more of their scientific institutions, their private companies to say, no, this is what responsible action is and how we advance our economic and scientific priorities rather than what's currently happening. So I think that the all of us part, we need a better handle on our governments.
Yeah, for sure. And because where I see the most cooperation on the planet is in the private sector, right? And by private sector, by the way, I'm not using the word commercial on purpose. Commercial to me is a subset of private sector. Private sector is academic, is religious, it is everything. It's all the other stuff that isn't the government. And most people just want to, they just want to do stuff. They just want to have stuff. They want to be taken care of, that kind of thing. They're not out to build empires in terms of geographic or astrographic, solographic or lunographic, whatever we call it when we get out on the moon, types of things. And one of the things, I had this thought experiment I want to toss at you, because I could see a situation where, let's say China goes to the South Pole. They've got the peaks of eternal light where the sun shines 24/7, 365, next to one of the dark craters where the ice is. And they pop down a research station there, and then they basically say, 20 kilometers, you have to respect our zone. I'm just picking a number there. And then it's a research station, but they would effectively own it. How do you deal with that kind of thing? What do you think? It's a thought experiment. I mean, so right. There's no wrong answer, but how would we deal with that?
And in our old treaties, we have this idea of space being, this common heritage of humankind. It's one of the public commons, similar to the ocean. You can't own the ocean, but you can own the fish and those resources. And then you have these exclusive economic zones around sovereignty. So I think we need to really reevaluate that. And what do public goods look like in space. And, you know, imagining worlds where we have millions of people, you know, on the moon in orbit, but there's only, you know, that one area where you can have constant solar power. You know, does that become a public good? Should everyone have access to that solar power? How do you govern that? I think is an interesting way of looking at it. You know, there also are other examples I think are fascinating in the indigenous spaces of looking at, you know, what does it look like to give personhood to natural objects, and even, you know, you can extend that to what would it look like to give personhood to these different areas on the moon, and how would these natural environments govern themselves? And that's of course without discovering biological life. I think that, you know, once we get to Mars, that becomes really interesting around planetary protection and what types of scientific advancements that we have to understand there. So I think that we're still in this research phase of what are, you know, we're just learning about all the resources that are on the moon, what we have to learn from the moon, and I think that we certainly can't let one country, one organization have control over those resources. That needs to be for the common heritage of humankind, but also it needs to be researched. It can't just be fenced off and as a, you know, as a preserve. I think there are real tangible benefits in uncovering those mysteries.
Yeah, and frankly, you and I are, with our prognostication and our philosophization, are where we are. But then the reality is going to be that's going to happen, right? They're just going to do it, right? No, nobody from China is calling you and me. I mean, you know, you and I. And I do work with Space Force a little bit, and they're thinking about these things. But there is no, they've got their head. They're basically looking back at the Earth. They're not trying to think about how. See, because in let's say in the South China Sea, whatever you want to call that area, if that happened, the first thing that would happen would be that probably a U.S. or allied aircraft or ship would run right through it just to demonstrate that it belongs to everybody, buddy, you know. And I don't see those capabilities being developed on the Earth. But on the other hand, it is, I don't know, I think it's something that we're really going to have to lean in on and get very clear on. We can't go, you know, you mentioned personhood of objects. I know what you're talking about. That is just the sacredness of, you know, that's what you mean. Nobody's going to date a rock. I mean, so we're not talking about that level of personhood, but
different types of legal distinctions of these different areas and how we relate to them.
Go ahead, though. Explain that a little more. I want to, yeah, let's talk just a second about that, because I'm sure somebody just heard you say personhood while we were, what do you mean? You're getting a moon rock personhood? I mean, no, my friend Bob Zubrin just clicked off.
This idea of legal personhood, you know, like we have this concept of corporations are people. But in places like New Zealand, they have watersheds or forests that have legal personhood, and it's this concept and put in trust of what is for the benefit for that specific area in itself. And so maybe we have some kind of international panel of trustees to determine what is the best sustainable development use case for this area, rather than just one country, one administration for determining these areas. I'm a fan of, you know, looking at you know, UNESCO World Heritage Sites, you know, imagining what, yes, you know, for all moonkind is advocating for these historical places, you know, looking at environmental areas. I think that there are lots of different legal tools to determine how we can consciously explore and settle space, rather than this model of, you know, planting a flag with our gun kind of thing.
Right. No, absolutely. And I'm glad you explained it that way, because it helps clarify it for people. Because there are people who just react, personhood, what do you mean? It's a rock. You know, it's a rock. It's like, no, it's a matter of respecting a shared asset that is multi-generational and goes beyond, you know, who we are and our immediate short-term profiting without the, or destructive profiting, let's say. Exactly. Destructive profitability, right? Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to come back, and we're moving into the last segment here, and this is a lot of fun, and I love dancing with you here, man. We're having some fun.
Likewise.
Welcome back to the Space Revolution, and it is indeed. We have one of the revolutionaries, Next Gen, on here with us, Ari Eisenstadt. So, Ari, I'm totally with you. You know, one of my I wrote a thing a while back, and it's called the Space Declaration. And, you know, the first part of that is very libertarian. It's basically, I'm going to go out there. I can do anything I want with any resources I find, you know, that kind of thing. And then the second part, which, by the way, the libertarians love that one. Then the second clause is unless, you know, or except, like, you know, I can't harm the earth. I can't harm any sacred spaces. I have to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's what we're after. Right. Would you agree that we're after this sort of a balance where, yes, human needs, individual right. By the way, just to remind you that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has a clause that says humans have the right to own property. Right. I love pulling that one out because everybody's focused on the space treaty. It's like, whoa, and then you're like, no, but here's this one that says this. And when I say property, I want to be very clear. I am not talking about a corporation going up there and grabbing, you know, a gazillion acres of the moon and saying it's theirs. But I do believe that if somebody goes up there and, shall we say, improves a piece of property in their family that they need, it needs to be inheritable or something like that. We're going to have to figure that out. But what is your take on that? I mean, how do you see sort of a responsible middle in the way that we open the frontier?
Definitely. And I think, you know, in short, we need good zoning laws. You know, what is residential, what's commercial, you know, what is protected public area on the moon in orbit, you know, deeper into space. But I think that we shouldn't have to sacrifice for, that's the idea of sustainable development, that we shouldn't have to stop using energy. We should just use clean energy. We shouldn't stop eating good food. We should have sustainable farming practices. We shouldn't have to have lower quality of education. We should have education for everyone. I think that that's really the benefit of this technological revolution that we're going for and through. And so I don't want us to have to make those choices of sacrifice. I think if we just do that, do things in the right intentional way, that we can create this post-scarcity economy and live out those highest expectations of humanity becoming multiplanetary. So I think that's why it's so important to have the conversation right now about figuring out how to do that in the right way and make sure that we don't have to make those sacrifices, that we can go to the moon, we can use that titanium, we can use that water, we can go to Mars. We can go to the asteroid belt. You know, I think it's all possible, and I think we just need to do it together.
Perfect. Good. Well said. And you kind of put a bow on the last 30 minutes of our conversation. So that was great. I am curious, in your own personal life, was there a moment, or was it just something you kind of got into over time that brought you into this arena, into the revolution? What happened, or did you just always nerd out? You know,
I think growing up in Florida, seeing those rocket launches, but there's certainly an element of fiction and sci-fi of seeing Star Wars, really imagining what that looks like. I think everyone looks at the night sky with wonder. Everyone has a deep connection to the moon. I think that the moon is really special. And I think it pains me to not have been to the moon since I've been alive, to not even have left low Earth orbit. And so I talk about how, yeah, I feel like we're these crustaceans at the bottom of the ocean floor. And, you know, every once in a while we get to swim up into the water like fish. A few people have jumped out like dolphins, but to really be able to evolve onto land, like that's the metaphor that I think of. And going and seeing these different leaders at NASA, at NASA Ames and quantum computing that happens there. I've been a part of the Conrad Foundation and seeing young people at Johnson Space Center, at Space Center Houston, designing new technologies around space. NASA headquarters, the work that they're doing there around social justice. And also, yeah, across UN agencies and imagining how these are extrapolated into space has been really inspiring.
That's great. You play a very important role in this. There are people in our cause who need to be our awareness of society. They need to be the sensors in terms of being aware that we're part of a society. It's not just machines. It's not just money. There are actual social interactions, societal responsibilities, and things like that we have. And I salute you for that. I'm going to ask you some of the silly questions. I think you just told me your favorite movie. But let's say you're getting out to the moon. You're finally making it. You got that ticket to ride. And you're cruising over the lunar surface at thousands of clicks. And you can feel the speed. What would you be listening to? What would you be jamming to?
I certainly have a special place in my heart for Pink Floyd and Dark Side of the Moon, and thinking about that. At this Texas Eclipse Festival, I'm really excited for all the music that will be there, from STS-9, the Disco Biscuits. We'll have Test Shot Starfish. They do the music for the SpaceX launches. Everyday Astronaut will be playing, and he'll be going on the Starship launch with Dear Moon. Big Gigantic, Tycho, Bob Moses. I think there's a lot of music to be listened to. But I'm really excited for the new era of music and art that will be created by these astronauts. And I think that's something special. So I'm looking forward to the music that will be available then by the time I get to go to the moon.
Fantastic. Best band ever, Pink Floyd. You win. We're done. We're good. So what was your favorite science fiction? I'm going to skip over the movie thing because you just said Star Wars. So I'm just going to go with that. What was your favorite science fiction book, if you had one, or author, either way?
Yeah, I think I think Asimov is an easy answer. But I want to give a big shout out to the showrunners of the new Foundation series on Apple. I think that's a really a great adaptation to the Foundation. But unfortunately, with my PhD, I don't get to read too much fiction. But I have I have had the opportunity to read almost every book written by astronauts. So creating this astronaut ethnography. And learning about their experiences and a really fascinating evolution from these hotshot fighter pilots of the Apollo Gemini area. Learning Michael Collins' book is fantastic, Carrying the Fire, to the space shuttle age, and books like from Eileen Collins and the first woman to be the commander of a mission, to now this long duration expeditionary spirit astronaut, that looking at like Scott Kelly and Nicole Stott, and certainly into the private era of astronauts. So that's been really cool. Learning from them and their experiences, I think are more powerful than any fiction.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I had the honor of knowing Isaac a little bit in one of my organizations, Space Frontier Foundation. We were the foundation, and he liked that. He thought that was cool. And we were like, well, but where's the second foundation? Very, very cool, man. You've obviously, I consider you one of the rising stars of the field. I just be frank about that. That's why I got you on the show. And when I spot somebody like yourself, it's always exciting to me, because you're just going and going and going. You smile a lot more than I do, which makes me slightly uncomfortable, but I'm cool with that. But just kidding. But I think that you represent something that's very exciting in terms of an invitation. You're basically, you are an invitation for people to get engaged in this amazing cause of ours, and it is a cause. So what would you say to someone out there, let's say a young person out there, maybe cynical, maybe whatever, you know, but they're kind of like into the space thing. What would you tell them as far as getting engaged, getting involved, participating? What would you suggest to somebody like that?
Yeah, I think there are many cynics. And I think first approaching it from why space is important, why space benefits humanity, Earth, sustainability, I think is really key. I think also, you know, as we go back to those questions around our favorite fiction, you know, it doesn't make good TV to live peacefully and prosperously. I think that we thrive on these conflicting stories and narratives, and you know, I think that that's been the theme of non-human intelligence, that there has to be conflict. And I think that we need new models. And to think of, you know, when I talk to astronauts, their goal and the vision for humanity in space is for it to be boring, for it to be something that is just a part of our lives, and we can go and travel to space and point to point on Earth easily. And so, yeah, I think it's about looking at how it becomes accessible to everyone, how we can make space travel affordable, and how we can solve our climate emergency, how we can solve some of these social issues. I think that's really the framework that I approach it from.
Yeah, it's funny you said that about the conflict thing. So for example, they're cycling through, and one of the movies that's on my screen right now on Netflix, right? Nothing to do with space. It's called Death on the Nile, right? And so you have these people who are like, well, why is there always war in space? I'm like, okay, Death on the Nile. So nobody dies. There's no movie. Everything's fine on the Nile. We're cruising. You know, you have to have these conflicts, and those are just tools and interaction. We understand that. But I have to tell you, man, I think that, again, what you're doing is great. I guess one last question I would have for you is your personal intention. What do you want to do next? What do you want to do in the next 4, 5, or 10 years? What do you personally, Ari, what is your goal? And we'll wrap it up with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been really exciting being across all these different sectors, from academia to teaching to the private sector, advising different companies to be producing these events like the Eclipse Festival, and looking forward to Texas, but then Spain in 2026, Egypt, Australia, and South Africa in 2030. So yeah, bringing together these experiences around space. I want to continue to do space advocacy with the United Nations Association, and recommend people to get involved in their local chapters and internationally, sharing about their vision for the future of humanity in space. And so, yeah, I think nonprofit and political advocacy is really important to me as well. My wife is on the board of trustees of the NAACP Foundation. So it's been really inspiring to see her and the work that she's done to increase diversity, equity, inclusion in the space industry. And it really humbling to see her speak at the White House Black Space Week event with astronaut Victor Glover, and really seeing what is being done by those civil rights leaders. So yeah, I hope to be in service to them in any way I can as well.
Thank you very much. Look, there's no point in going unless we all go together. It's all about all of us. And this time we don't take it from anybody. This time we give it to everybody. That's our job. And Ari, I think you're one of the people that's going to help make sure we do that the right way. So thank you for coming, my brother. And I appreciate you being on. All right, Spacers. Thank you for attending one more round of the Space Revolution. My name is Rick Tomlinson. You've been listening to this little show of ours, and I hope you've had a good time. I hope it's enlightened you a little bit. And right now, we are out the airlock.
You've been listening to the Space Revolution podcast with Rick Tomlinson, a production of iRock Space Radio. Go to iRockSpaceRadio.com for more.